When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.
This episode of Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. If you would like to learn how to support this podcast, visit www.patreon.com/writingexcuses. Season 19, Episode 40. This is Writing Excuses.
An interview on tension with P. Jelly Clark.
I'm Mary Robinette.
I'm Erin.
I'm Howard.
And today we are joined by our special guest, P. Jelly Clark. We hope that you've been reading along and listening as we've been talking about his phenomenal book, Ring Shout. And we've brought him in to talk to us about the ways in which he tortured us through the tension. Fenderson, do you want to introduce yourself to our audience?
Sure thing. Thanks for having me here. I'm Fenderson Jelly Clark, people probably know me as P. Jelly Clark. I write stuff, mostly science fiction when I can, apart from my day job where I'm an academic historian. So this is how I tend to let off steam. And thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. So this was, I've talked about this with the listeners before that this was a really difficult read for me because you do crank up the tension quite a bit. And, there's a number of scenes that we will discuss. But one of the things that I'm wondering about when you sat down to work on this, were you thinking about, like the historical era, or were you thinking about how can I make people super uncomfortable? Like what kind of, what drove you?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think perhaps a little bit of both, one subconsciously, one consciously. Certainly I was thinking of the historical era. As I said, I'm an academic historian. One of the classes I teach is slavery in film. So I've gotten to know Birth of a Nation by D.W. Griffith, the 1915 film where the Klan are heroes quite well. And I was trying to figure out a way to bring that story to people in the genre I love. And so Ring Shout came about from that central focus, as well as we can talk about a lot of other little interesting ideas from ex-slave narratives that I'd read, from stories that I've liked when I was younger. People may catch some Miss Who's It, Miss What's It, and what have you, from Wrinkle in Time, down to the aesthetics of Beyonce's Formation video. There were multiple inspirations that I threw into this big pot of gumbo and hoped that it would work.
I absolutely love that. Like, I will say I did not catch all of that, or most of it probably, but I remember when I, you know, got the Birth of a Nation comes in really early. And when I was like, oh, I see what he was doing. He took this thing, he took this other thing, and he put them together into this thing. And it really made me feel good. It made me feel like, okay, like all the time that I've spent, like, you know, watching like sad narratives about slavery and post, you know, in the 20s and, you know, all those Eyes on the Prize that my parents made me watch. It's all finally like paying off, which I thought was a really, really fun thing. But I have to wonder, like, does it ever feel like too much? Do you ever feel like I'm trying to juggle all these influences and not get overwhelmed by them.
Well, yeah, when I was, that's a great question. When I was doing this, when I finished it, I was like, well, this is a mess. I was like, there's just way too much going on here. Why don't I just throw some space aliens in here while I'm at it? Right. There's just so much going on. I didn't know this thing would work. And I always say as writers, sometimes you create something that I didn't have a full genre for it. I was like, this is all over the place. And I didn't know how it would be received. And I was pleasantly surprised, shocked even at times that you guys like this. OK, great. And so, you know, it's one of those things where you take scotch tape and you put together this giant thing. You don't know if it's going to work. And it did. And I don't even know if I could recreate it again. Because it was such a an in the moment.
Yeah, you're looking at your editor. You're like, wait, you took a heat gun to the scotch tape? No, we were supposed to fix that.
Yeah.
And so I have to ask this question. Did you still feel like it was a mess when it went to print?
Oh, no. Again, luckily, so many people had read it and given it all these great. I was like, oh, it worked. I was like, I guess what I was going for worked. I was still surprised. I still am surprised at how many people like it, how much it's liked. I've gone to other countries and people have read it. When it was something that I wrote kind of as a stopgap before my first novel, so people would remember, hey, this guy's so right.
Okay, I'm here to tell you that whatever that gap was, yeah, you stopped it.
Yeah.
It is well and truly stopped.
So it worked. And I'm happy, right? I certainly... Anything, I think, as any writer, you certainly have these deeper meanings. But I didn't know if everybody would get them, like Aaron was saying. I didn't know if people would be able to latch on to these things. And people really did. And I'm just grateful.
It was one of the things that we talked about when we were earlier when we were discussing the idea of the narrative versus contextual tension, that there's the tension that happens on the page in the story. And then there's the tension that the reader brings to it, the contextual tension that the reader brings to it by what they know about history, right, and what they know about the larger world. And you do a really good job, I think, of making sure that there is narrative tension there, even for people who do not have a deep understanding of the contextual tension. I think that's why it works when you go to another country that is not as familiar with the history of American, yeah, slavery and oppression. When were you thinking about that? Like when you were structuring scenes that you were like, oh, I need to make sure that there's something here for people who are a little clueless.
I wish I was doing that consciously. That would be great. Because then I could hold forth and have a very long discussion like Max Gladstone on how things work. And I wish that I had that ability, but really, so much of my writing is from the fact that I love reading. I love, yeah, listening to storytellers. My mother was an excellent storyteller. My mother could give you directions and it was riveting, right? She would build up tension. You're like, oh, man, I got it. Which lane I'm supposed to switch into? That's amazing. And so I think I brought some of that to this. And, you know, it's just, I knew that I wanted to tell this larger story, like you said, about ideas of oppression, about it, to bring in slavery and everything else. But I also wanted to make it a people story. I wanted the characters to shine. Mm-hmm. I wanted them to have their own lived experiences and how I would imagine people dealing with everyday life, of, you know, having a love life and not getting along with the people in your little monster hunting group, how you would butt heads with people that you have to work with. I wanted to bring all of that to the story as well. In some ways, to make it more human so people can relate to it. And also to show that in the midst of this oppression, people still go to a juke joint, right? Yeah. People are still talking about sex and all these other things in life, that it's not just fighting the oppression, it's people living their lives. And I wanted to make sure I got that across well.
Oh my God.
There was a lot of joy in that book for me.
Yeah.
Gosh, I can't remember which scene it was. I remember which scene it wasn't. It wasn't the scene in the butcher shop.
Oh my God.
But there was a scene where I literally had to go make some jambalaya because you made me hungry for,
yeah,
the food of my people, you know, yeah, for some of that deep South cooking. And
yeah.
Mm.
Oh yeah. I think food is one of the unsung heroes of world building.
Yeah.
And there's a way that I think food can evoke things. I've been in movies before where people like show a plate and I can hear people behind me going, I heard someone's stomach growl once in a film. I think it was in the movie Soul Food. Somebody's stomach growled in reaction. You don't know what I'm talking about, Aaron, when they show that one plate. And I'm like, they're like, And I thought it was thinking ironic that I was like, you know, the very plot of this movie is that food killed. Anyway, but people love the food. And so I think there's a way that I'm glad you said that, that I noticed scene you're right talking about, like when they're sitting down to eat. I just want to show that communal experience of eating and enjoying these things after, you know, having a hard fought battle. What's better than sitting down, you know, like in the first Avengers movie, you go and you have some shawarma, right? There's something about that that's just very real. Yeah. I think food is the unsung hero. I tell it to writers all the time. Don't neglect your food.
Mm. And if the food is bad, that tells you something too. You know, you get out there with your low vibrational plate after the monster hunting, and it's not a good thing.
Exactly. But
what it made, when you were talking about like the oppression versus the real life, it made me think of one of my favorite things to do is to look at old black and white, you know, photos where they actually colorize it, because I think people forget, like, people were living in color, you know what I mean? Like, but instead we like put them on the wall like they're not real. And when you see them, like, I just think I saw one the other day, it was like Martin Luther King looking.
Martin Luther King and Coretta Scott.
Yes!
In a green outfit. So good, yes. And people were like, ooh, they was fly. And you're like, exactly. Yeah, did you think they dressed in black and white? And I think that's so true as a historian, how people think of the past. And it's hard sometimes for people to think of the past as those were people, right? And all of these events were happening, but they were still people living their lives, bickering, getting along, joking. They were just people. And yes, they dressed in color. They matched things. People thought in the past, it's just, I guess my gray drab suit, my other gray drab suit, and I'll head out. No, you know, it was, but there is something about that, how it brings to life. I'm so glad you brought that up. I saw that exact image and it evoked it in me, even though I understand that. And it's still, it's something human about seeing those colors that, you know, makes you understand, like, yeah, these are people.
Well, when you coming back to tension for a moment, being able to sit down to a meal, that's a that's a relief. That is a that is a relaxing thing. And if you let your reader relax into some food that they are, you know, imagining, and you're describing it and they're getting the smells and the tastes and the sounds and all that. And then you spring a monster on them later. It's going to be even sharper. It's going to work even better. Yeah. And I loved that. I don't know if you were doing it deliberately, but as I had gone upstairs eating the jambalaya, I was thinking, I may have walked into a trap here. I may have walked right into a trap. I'm letting my guard down. Something terrible is going to happen very next.
Yeah, I think that's a good point you're making. I don't even know if I do it deliberately, but I think, like, I'll tell you what, there are some stories I read and there's so much action. I'm like, do people stop and go to the bathroom here? You got to stop at some point. There has to be a pause, right? And I'm really big into, if I'm reading a story, so I want to pause. I want people to go to their house. I want people to stop. And I think, especially after that big scene, I wanted to pause. Nothing like that communal, like you said, there's this way that people let their guard down when they're eating, especially if they feel they're in a safe place here with people. And then there's also still a time, that was my time to let people, you know, to for Sadie and you know, and Maurice to still have their little bickering bit, right? But also to show that they're closer than people know, right? And I also at the juke joint, right? I could have easily made this a weird Mean Girls thing where they just don't get along. But I want to show that, no, underneath all that, they absolutely love each other, right? That Sadie will tear down this world for Maurice, even if they also bicker. And I think, you know, there were those scenes that allowed me to do that. And I really liked it. When I started the story, for instance, starting there with that conversation, you know, I did worry because, you know, we're taught like, oh, the story should start. Don't have them, you know, don't have people in conversation. And I was like, no, I want this conversation. I want this convo in the very beginning to start the story off. And, you know, I thought there I could build a little tension between this group. And then the tension explodes when, oh, there's a monster. Right, shows up. Yeah.
Plus, I think in real life, I think we talked about this on the episode, like we all are much more likely to have tension in our conversations than because monsters attack us. Like, that's the kind of tension we understand. Like, much of, I mean, I don't know what y'all do in your spare time. But in general, so it's like, it feels so real. And then you're like, and it goes to 11. It's sort of, I was thinking about, Howard, what you said about the food. When you read a food scene, it's like your nose opens up. Like you suddenly think about how things smell. And then if the next thing you smell is like, you know, monster, like you're taking that in with a full whiff, you know, because you're in that moment and you're ready for it. And all your senses are already being engaged versus like sometimes when you know tension is happening as a reader, like you'll tense up, your hands will curl, you won't take in full breaths because you're so in the moment. And so I kind of like the idea that there's enough slowdown that we're just chilling, we're laying back, and then pow.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite things also, that the making the reader feel like, oh no, you're safe now. This is all fine.
Everything's
all
cool.
Fine. Yeah. And then very not, very, very not. I actually, since we were talking about that first scene, I had a question as well, that kind of, I had been thinking about it when I was reading it, but then when Howard said, oh no, this is a trap, there are potential narrative traps as a writer, in some of the things, you know, anytime we're writing. One of the things that when I was reading it, I was waiting for the parade to turn on them, because that's something that I would have seen in cinema, or, you know, that in the hands of another writer. And you take us a very different place. You know, with Hello Monsters and then going into the warehouse, which like is full and should not be full. And like, and so you keep ratcheting it up the tension, but you avoid the obvious one. Yeah. Did you avoid that because you were just not interested in writing it, because it was a little bit of a trap, or is, you know, I realize that asking someone to tell us what you were thinking when you were writing this, however many years it is after you wrote the book, is like monumentally unfair. And yet I'm still asking.
And you notice as a writer, it's also like a retcon, right? People are always asking you to figure out why you did the thing you did. And I end up coming up with an answer. I was like, is that true? Or am I just writing myself a story? And like, am I imagining that's what I was thinking at the time? And so I know that's interesting that you say that you thought the crowd was going to turn on them, right? Because they're in this dangerous place. There's certainly a Klan march, right? And so I don't think I ever thought of the crowd turning on them. I knew that they were going to be doing something away from what most people can see, only because what they have to do is so wild that everyone can't see this, right? It has to be like, this is the secret, you know, underground world, like Blade. Like, nobody knows I'm fighting vampires, right? This is what I do. This is the, what does he say in the movie? There's the candy-coated world and there's the one underneath, right? And I wanted to get that idea of like, there's this underneath world that most people are simply unaware of. And for that, to me, it had to happen away from the main crowd. It had to happen away from the main block of people for them to be able to have this open warfare. And the warehouse came to me. I mean, this is where I literally had I've been to Macon, Georgia, but I had a map and I had a warehouse that was actually there. That's from an actual warehouse. I have photos of it. It was actually used to house cotton. And so it gave me something from a landscape to look down upon. Mm-hmm. And then I knew like, I want to fight in a warehouse. Why not? That's a great place, right? Because I like having fights in places that you just shouldn't be having fights in, right? Like, I think schools, hospitals, warehouses, just like this, that's not what this is for, but this is what we're going to turn it into, right? And so, yeah, that's how that came about.
That's fantastic. Now I'm sitting here going, what is for having battles?
I was like, playgrounds? Yeah. Playgrounds are really, that's the top place.
But those are the best fight scenes, right? There really isn't a good place.
No.
To have if you watch
Star Wars, like they're constantly having fights in industrial centers, and like somebody said, hey, we're working here. Yes. People with lightsabers running around. It's like, you know, we're just trying to get this work done.
Yeah.
You guys are jumping around, causing problems.
If you break that, everyone dies.
Yeah.
Does OSHA know what you guys are doing right now?
Right. Yeah, every time there's a fight scene that runs through a kitchen and the cooks just keep on cooking while they're going through, I'm like, what? That's how is that?
Table 17. Like, it needs jambalaya.
They're more scared of Chef than they are of Dave.
Yeah, they are. Basically.
Well, speaking of interrupting things when fights go running through, we're going to interrupt right here and be back in just a moment to talk a little bit more about tension.
This episode of Writing Excuses is sponsored in part by Acorns. Money can be a difficult topic for writers and creative professionals. It's not like earning a regular paycheck that comes in at reliable intervals. It requires more careful planning to make sure that that advance covers you not just this year, but sets you up for the future as well. Learning to invest and be smart with your money takes time and research, and it's easy to put that off in favor of short-term goals. I encourage all the writers I work with to read up on the options out there and do their homework to figure out what makes sense for them. Acorns makes it easy to start automatically saving and investing in your future. You don't need a lot of money or expertise to invest with Acorns. In fact, you can get started with just your spare change. Acorns recommends an expert-built portfolio that fits you and your money goals, then automatically invests your money for you. Head to acorns.com/WX or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing your future today. Client testimonial, compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/WX.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
My thing of the week is I am always late on TV shows. And I tell this to everybody, we live in a golden era of television. There is more fantastic TV than has ever existed in my lifetime. I no longer have to choose between The A-Team, Knight Rider, and Automan. That was like a weird show, but I got turned to a car. Very ridiculous. In the 80s. 80s was a wild time. But now there's so much TV, but I'm always late. And so what I've decided to watch this week is something that came out on in 2019. It is a short series called The Terror, and it is on Netflix. And it's about these two British ships, the Erebus and the Terror, and I think it's the Terror, trying to find a way through the Northwest Passage. And woo boy, do strange things begin to happen. And I've long wanted to watch this film, but then it went away. And now, thanks to the magic of Netflix, it's returned. And I am able to watch it. And when this is over, I'm going to enjoy another episode, as I do constantly. So yeah, that's my thing. Some of you have seen it. If you haven't, The Terror. Watch it at night.
No.
Making mental notes, do not take Fenderson's advice. All right, so here we are back on the other side. The heroes have fought their way through our kitchen, and we're here to talk about some more ingredients of tension. So I was so pleased with myself for that metaphor. It's not really great.
We loved it. Yeah.
It's thank painful. You. I appreciate you. Yes. So some of the other things that we talked about were things like anticipation and resolution. There's a bunch of stuff that you set up early on that then has a nice payoff later. For instance, talking about the film that's going to be on Stone Mountain. Mm-hmm. And you talk about that right at the beginning of the book. And then it comes back and plays, it continues to play larger and larger role as we move through the book. Did you always have like, and we're going to go to Stone Mountain?
Yeah, I always knew we were going to Stone Mountain. We were always going to Stone Mountain because part of the origin of this entire thing is the fact that in real life, the Second Klan has its origins on Stone Mountain, mm-hmm. right? It literally is created after D.W. Griffith releases Birth of a Nation in 1915, which is where the Klan of Heroes. By this time, the First Klan has mostly died out because they got what they wanted. They've taken over. They've got instituted Jim Crow. The Second Klan comes about really based on the film. The film so inspires this guy, Al Simmons, in Georgia, that he decides to create the Second Klan. And this Second Klan now has, it still hates Black people, but it has a larger enemies list. Now it doesn't like Catholics, it doesn't like German immigrants, it really doesn't like Jews. In fact, it is the killing of Leo Frank. The murder of Leo Frank is very much tied up with this Second Klan being born in Georgia. And he goes to Stone Mountain and they do a ritual. And the ritual is based heavily on the film, The Birth of a Nation. Wow. And, you know, it would almost be, if the group is not a terror group, it'd almost be funny to call them the movie clan. Because the way they dress, many of the rituals they do are based more on the film, Birth of a Nation, than the first Klan that comes about, right? And the Second Klan, of course, is much more massive, whereas the first Klan was maybe tens of thousands. This Klan rises to some 4.5 million, whereas the first Klan was mostly in the South and also in California, where they're harassing the Chinese. The Second Klan is everywhere. It's swallowed up the Midwest. It's in Maine. It's in Connecticut. It's everywhere. They're running people for office. They're not even wearing masks because everyone can be a member of the Klan, right? And so I always knew I was going to Stone Mountain because Stone Mountain was that symbol. To this day, Stone Mountain is still a place where Klan and white supremacists meet. And it has these giant reliefs on there, actually, of Confederate generals like Lee and others, right? So it's still this place, this tension. And so I always knew I wanted to go there. And yeah, I definitely seeded it in the beginning because I'm a believer that if you give somebody something right in the store, I want to see it later on. Don't just put it there. And I like to give people clues so that they can know that's coming. Like when I first saw M. Night Shyamalan's, what's the movie with Bruce Willis in the...
Sixth Sense.
Sixth Sense. I love the fact that when we figure it out, we were like, oh, the clues were always there, right? And we just saw it differently. So I like to make certain that I've seeded things so that when they do happen, people aren't like, whoa, what are you doing to Stone Mountain? I want them to get these little hints before and then, you know, take them there. Yeah. See, I'm an academic historian, so you ask me things, I have to plug the history.
Listen, I was right there with you. I spent a lot of time in Atlanta, and I was, as you were talking, I was thinking about a friend of mine who went to Atlanta for a job and was picked up by his boss at the airport. Mm. His boss took him, the first stop they made on the way from the airport to the job was at Stone Mountain.
Ah, okay. Cool. It's still a place people go. It's beautiful scenery.
Well, yeah, it's contextually a little more challenging when the person showing up for the job is a young Black man and it's an older white guy who takes him there.
Okay. It's not the best place. Especially if you know the history. I was like, yeah, why are we here?
Yeah. Yeah. Those are questions that are still being asked.
Yeah. One of the things that I love the most about Ring Shout, I'm a middle-aged white dude who grew up in Florida. I have zero childhood knowledge of the history that you're talking about. That was all completely obscured from me. It's just been in the last 10 years that I've been looking back and realizing, oh, wow, I know nothing. Well, less than 50% of what was happening in that time period, in that area. And the way you wrote the novel, I was able just contextually to tell immediately, okay, this is P. Jelly Clark creating a fiction, and this is P. Jelly Clark telling me history.
Yeah.
And that dance that you did between the fantastic that you wove through your story in order to create a mythos that was brilliant and wonderful and horrific and full of scary meat versus
still mad about that
versus the history, which is I am ashamed for not knowing it sooner. But that dance you did was wonderful. I loved the book for that.
No, thank you. And unfortunately, in Florida, they're trying to make it so that people will not know these things.
Yeah.
And I just think that there is this way that I think you're hitting on the head. There are these aspects of American history that just aren't spoken about. I think about when HBO redid Watchmen, and they decided to do it from a perspective of Tulsa, Oklahoma. Tulsa, Oklahoma is something that I've known about since I was a kid, because in Black spaces, it's just talked about. Even if people don't know everything, they've heard of Black Wall Street. They know what happened there. People just bring it up. My parents are from the Caribbean, and you know, so they didn't come here until like the late 60s, early 70s, and they knew about it. I heard about it in a barbershop somewhere. And it's just something I knew, but most people, even the showrunner for that show, and he was a 40-something-year-old white male, he said he had never heard of it, right? Until like a few years before. And it fascinated him, and he went to look for it, and therefore he knew he had to put this into the film. That night that it premiered, I think Google almost broke, because people were Googling, what is Tulsa, Oklahoma? What happened there? Now it's just become something that everyone knows, but there is this way that there are a lot of things that, you know, the national narrative doesn't like to talk about. That doesn't make us feel good. And so these kinds of things become knowledge to like a few people, where it's just known in the Black community, like this thing happened, but in the large community, it's just completely unheard of. And so, yeah, part of what I was doing as the historian in me, I'm trying to bring these things out by using fiction, right? And what inspired me for a lot of this, what inspired the story, were actually the ex-slave narratives taken from the last generation of enslaved people who were living in the 1920s, especially the 1930s, during the Great Depression, the WPA narratives. And they talk about this first Klan, and they describe them as monsters. And when I was like, whoa, that's amazing. Now, they know they're not monsters, but they're using this notion of describing the Klan as haints, saying that they have horns, that they could drink tons of water, do these supernatural acts, and they have chains, and they would blacken their faces. I always have this idea that they're using this idea of storytelling to talk about the trauma that they were facing from, right? Turning these people, who they knew they were, like, yeah, that's Judge so-and-so. I know who he is. Like, he owned me, or I worked for him, but he dresses up, and he comes, and he terrorizes us. And what better way to talk about your trauma than using horror, which is what, you know, the scholar Kenitra Brooks, she always says, this is what horror is, right? It's about us trying to find a way to talk about trauma. And so all this to say, I took my cue from these former slaves using folklore to talk about this history and saying, what if I did that as well? And it was this me constantly trying to make it not get too historical. So that people are like, well, no, it's history. I'm running away. But imbuing it with the fiction enough to keep people there in the story.
Yeah, I think that you just did a great job of walking that line. I also enjoy writing historical fiction. And,
yes.
And the tension.
Very well.
Thank you. The tension that you can mm-hmm. put on things by inviting the reader in to... Yeah. I feel like when you use real history, you are making space for the reader because you're engaging their curiosity in a way that mm-hmm. that it is harder, I think, with some other forms of fiction. One of the things that you did.
Oh, sorry. This might be a little on the nose, but I feel like our listeners at this point really need to be able to draw a line between the way Birth of a Nation as a medium, as a story, was so incredibly destructive. I mean, it was very influential on culture, but it was very, very destructive. And the stories that we tell now that attempt to correct mm-hmm. can be so corrective. Writing is important, and getting it right is important. Mm-hmm. Telling a story that will sing to people and can change them is important. This is a good work that you did, that we want to do. It is a good work.
Thank you. That's great to hear. I mean, so much of, yeah, I can't say I didn't write this in a sense of thinking a corrective or for my own catharsis. You know, people hunting Klan members. Yeah.
Yeah. You know,
it's cathartic. And so thank you. That's great to hear. Like I said, when I say I wrote this with the idea that a few people might like it, I still had this idea of this is what I want people to get from it. And that people come away with this notion of it as a corrective, but also this giving them this inquisition to go, I want to find out more. As a historian, of course, I want you to find out more. I want you to be able to look and say, oh, wow, this was a real part of history. This is a fictional part, but like you said, these things actually happened. And so thank you very much. That's what you make me want to go write.
Please do.
Yes, please. Please do write more. One of the things that I just want to draw a line under that that Fenderson is talking about, that that Howard has mentioned, is that that Fenderson wrote this for himself. And we talked about the idea of writing for of having a story that's written for an in-group, a group that has a shared common experience, and then knowing that people who are out-group are also going to read it and engage with it. And I want you to understand. I want you to bear in mind that this is something that he wrote for himself, and it is when you are sitting down to write something, the thing that you can do to make it most true and most interesting is to write something for yourself.
Yeah.
And I think not be apologetic about it.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Yeah. I think that there are, the world will tell you like, oh, you need to approach this really carefully and you need to, you know, and it's not to say that you can just do whatever you want, but especially when you're talking about things that are about what you know, what you grew up with, the things that your family talked about, you know, the things that are part of your history. I think it's what I really liked about this book is that it's bold. You know what I mean? It's not shirking from engaging the past. You know, it's going all the way in. And this is gonna, I'm gonna take a complete 90 degree turn here for no reason other than I can. y'all can't stop me, which is that I also think tone is so interesting and important, because one of the things I always love about the Klan, not an actual thing, but my favorite part is that one of the things that undercut them was when comic books started mocking them, that actually it was these are ridiculous people who took hate in a weird movie and decided to like cosplay evil. And when that was being made fun of by like old school comics, they were like, oh, we can't recruit as much, because it turns out that our stuff, like, we aren't able to get the recruitment. It's not scary anymore. It just feels silly. And so I think there's so many different tones, and I'm curious, like, what made you decide to go like all the way in horror? Because there's something ridiculous about it, but also something horrifying.
Yeah, it's interesting thinking about recent happenings in politics and Ocean Bet, when you can make hate mongers and fascists, when you make them feel weird and simply laugh at them, how much power that robs from them, right? The fact that you can do that. So that's an interesting point that you're making there. In this case, again, I was taking my cue so much from those ex-slaves who had written. I should point this out that I first read those narratives when I was doing a master's degree 10 years before I would sit down to write Ring Shout. Those ideas, I was introduced to those ideas I was introduced to the Night Doctors in those narratives. And I kind of sat and I knew, like I said, I want to do something with this. I didn't know what. And then, so it took me 10 years before I was like, okay, I'm ready to actually approach this. And so I want to say that I was really trying to honor the fact that they gave me these wonderful ideas and trying to be truthful to it. And yeah, like, you know, so much of it was, I wanted to show the horror of it. And so it's also absurd, right? Like, Butcher Clyde is absurd, but he's also terrible. And I wanted to have that bridge between absurdity, but also it's frightening, right? And I just wanted to get that down. And the notion that, you know, there's a point where Nana Jean says, like, the Klan members who haven't turned yet, she calls them, like, fools, right? I wanted to get this idea that they're dressing up and they're clowns. They're foolish, right? But if they let that hate consume them, they can become this monstrous danger that can destroy others. But she says of the ones who aren't, she says they're fools, right? She said, and she makes this distinction between the fools or the ones who've turned. But I wanted to get that across. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you walked those lines really nicely. On the subject of the narratives, the slave narratives, you've got a bunch of the sections that are transliterated from the Gullah.
Yeah.
And I loved, like, I got, they're just so juicy and I love them all. But I'm looking at notation 25 in particular, the shout Eve and Adam tell about them to listening to that wicked snake and eating the fruit from the forbidden tree. That one, it's interesting to me the way it is talking about the shout and how you wind up using the shout later.
Yeah.
So I'm curious again, like having the, there's so many decisions that go into making these kind of interludes. There's the, where do you place it? There's the content. There's the tone of it. There's the, you know, like how many of these are you jumping straight off of something that you had read? How many of them are, you are completely riffing on your own? I don't have a question there. I just want you to talk about them.
No, thank you. Cause I don't get asked about those shout forms. Those parts were so important to me because I thought they set the tone for each chapter. They were able to say so much in their, in between these little interludes. And I actually pulled a lot of that from, first of all, I looked at actual shouts. I wanted to know what the shouts were about. Mm. And so each one is pulled from an actual different shout. And I thought the shouts were so fascinating because I said, this is philosophy. People are giving, and I even have something on there where somebody says how many intellectual and philosophers were lost to the drolling work of slavery and so forth. How many did you lose? How many minds who could have thought up these fascinating things? And I thought when I was, there was the shouts themselves, and I've read people who were interpreting the shouts. And some of these were Lomax and others who were first doing the interviews. Later, there are books that, you know, that talk about the shout where people say, well, this is what the shout is about. And as I'm listening to these people, I was like, this is philosophical. They're talking about how humans think about themselves and their place in the universe and how it was all of that, right? It's as deep as Kant and anybody else. And that's what I wanted to get across here. In these shouts by, and so some of it comes from quotes that I'd read, and I'm also adding my own take to it and my own riffing of it and trying to give an interpretation, but trying to let their voices come through there. And I have this transliterated because if anybody noticed, that's supposed to be, not remembering her name, our favorite Jewish radical who's a member of the Monster High fighting crew. If anybody knows, those are her initials. She's the one who supposedly wrote this. Yeah. So I'm putting that little bit in there. And I kind of have her as a Lomax or something, like using that the way that they would write about what they saw. So it's a bit of that. But yeah, each one was important. Each one was supposed to kind of be linked to the chapter that was coming. And you should know that I also had little quotes that I wanted from slave narratives themselves, direct quotes, and they ended up having to go because I think, like you said, there people were like, "Okay, you have the interludes, then you have the little narratives from the chapter. That's too much." And so it was one of those things like, "Oh, it hurt," but I had to cut them all out. But I kept one, and that is in the very in my acknowledgments, the one about Lulu's ma, who's like, the clan came in, they came into her house and she whooped them one at a time. That's an actual quote. I love that. Because here she's talking about her mama, like, I mean, just fantastical. Her mother is just, it's so Paul Bunyan, John Henry. Clan members came in, I'm holding a baby, I'm just beating each clan member one at a time. I said, I have to keep this quote in here. And so there were a lot of quotes like that. I wanted to get these voices of these ex-slaves, but I definitely kept that one about Lulu's ma. Yeah.
Awesome.
I love the way you were thinking about, you know, as you were talking about the shouts and the stories and the narratives, because so much of the way I took some of this actual story is it's about the stories we tell ourselves.
Yeah.
It's about the stories we allow ourselves to tell, the ones that we hold back, the ones we're afraid of, the ones we shouldn't fear. And so much of it being rooted in you wanting to tell people stories, I think is just really cool and deep and like an extra level knowing that was part of what went into it.
Yeah. And when you said that, that the shouts were, philosophy and about knowing, you know, about thinking about their place in the universe, I'm like, that is what this entire book is. Maurice trying to figure out her place in the universe.
Yeah.
So well done.
This episode is titled, you know, Discussing Tension. And the real tension I'm seeing here is your tension that you relieved by writing this book.
In some ways,
it was done and it was out and you told that story. And
I wrote this book in a few weeks because it was one of those things, and you know, as writers, you have this idea. I pitched the idea months before. It was due like in August. I hadn't written a thing. But I had the idea was in my head. I'd been percolating with this story for several years, but I just hadn't let it float out. And when it flowed out, like, I think it was like 2-3 weeks, I just wrote it. Let's just get it all out.
I think this is where one writer says to another in a friendly, collegial way, "You asshole."
Thank you.
I wrote this award-winning book in just a couple of weeks. You know,
imagine the idea for it. Like, I'd taken this stuff like a decade before, but sometime around, I would say around 2015 or so, I really started thinking.
Yeah,
I was on a fellowship. My last fellowship was working my dissertation in Indiana, Pennsylvania, literally nowhere, Pennsylvania. My wife came to visit me one time there when she lived in D.C. She's like, "I'm not coming back again. I saw tractor pulls and people chasing grease pigs at a fair." So, OK, that's fair. So I would drive almost every weekend back to D.C., several hour drive. And I'd be driving through these misty mountains. I don't know if anybody ever listens to Old Gods of Appalachia, but it was that. Right. Mm-hmm. And so while I'm driving, I'm listening to some shouts. I'm listening to these songs sometimes, and I'm just imagining. And so there was a way where, talking about build up tension, I had so much of it in me that when it came out, it just all poured out because it was something I'd been sitting with for so long that when I finally came to write it, I could just write it.
So what I'm hearing is, if you want to write a book in 3 weeks, think the book for a decade.
Oh, yeah, that works. Yeah,
sure. Yeah, that's absolutely.
That's reassuring. There are several things I've been thinking about for a decade, so like I feel like any day now.
Yeah, I've had things that I've had to sit on for a while, and that's a question that we get a lot from listeners or early career writers who are like, "I have this idea, but I don't know if I'll be able to do it justice." I'm like, it's okay to sit on it. Yeah. It's okay to sit on it and think about it and noodle on it until write other things while you're leveling up.
Yes.
Speaking of leveling up and writing other things, I think it's time for us to give some homework. And Finderson, I think you have homework for us.
Yes. If anyone is really interested in building tension and storytelling over a short amount of time, I have something that you can go watch if you've seen it already. I want you to Netflix. I want you to find somebody else's Netflix if you need to. And I want you to watch Midnight Mass. And I want you to watch a show that builds so many different areas of tension. Like, by the time it all hits, you will have realized, I haven't slept in 12 hours. I've just been watching this show. And you are a balled up knot of tension watching and trying to figure out what's going to happen next. Just an amazing show. Midnight Mass, if you have not seen it yet. And by Howard's face, Howard has seen it.
That's awesome homework. You're out of excuses. Now go turn into a balled up knot.
Yeah.
Have you ever wanted to ask one of the Writing Excuses hosts for very specific, very you-focused help? There's an offering on the Writing Excuses Patreon that will let you do exactly that. The private instruction tier includes everything from the lower tiers, plus a quarterly one-on-one Zoom meeting with a host of your choice. You might choose, for example, to work with me on your humorous prose, engage Dong Wan's expertise on your world building, or study with Aaron to level up your game writing. Visit patreon.com/writingexcuses for more details.
Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. Your hosts for this episode of Writing Excuses were Mary Robinette Kowal, Aaron Roberts, Howard Taylor, with our special guest, P. Jelly Clark. This episode was engineered by Marshall Carr Jr., mastered by Alex Jackson, and produced by Emma Reynolds. For more information, visit writingexcuses.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Make the right call for the right Medicare Advantage benefits. Go to MedMutual.com/review to schedule your free Medicare plan review with Medical Mutual, Ohio's hometown Medicare insurer.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.